To the edge of the universe for spooky action. This week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Way, way beyond. I've got something very special I've wanted to share with you for many weeks. We'll sit down with four outstanding physicists for a conversation about the riddle of quantum mechanics and what Einstein called spooky action at a distance. It will take us from the smallest distances possible to some of the most distant objects in the cosmos. You'll hear less than half of the complete conversation. Every bit of it can be found online in the podcast version of this week's show. That's where you'll also hear from Planetary Society Senior Editor Emily Lakdawalla about the new spring solstice issue of the Planetary Report, our magazine that is available to all at planetary.org/TPR. We also enjoy a short visit with our chief advocate, Casey Dreyer, that was generated by an apparently offhand tweet from the President of the United States about whether we should be headed to the moon on the way to Mars. It's all at planetary.org/radio. Nova is the long-running, award-winning series of science documentaries on PBS, the public broadcasting service in the United States. Back on January 9th, it helped get the new year rolling with the dramatic tale of Einstein's quantum riddle. 2 months later, two of the film's stars were at the University of California, San Diego, as guests of the Arthur C. Clarke Center for Human Imagination. Andrew Friedman is an assistant research scientist in the UCSD Center for Astrophysics and Space Sciences, while Jason Galicchio is a professor of physics at Harvey Mudd College. Andrew and Jason were major players in the experiment at the heart of the film, in spite of hardships and setbacks, including a nearly disastrous windstorm. They and their team managed to use two quasars, those hugely distant, hugely ancient sources of energy, to refine our knowledge of that strange but wonderful property called entanglement. Thanks to the Clarke Center, I was allowed to sit down with Andrew and Jason. Joining us were two more physicists. Experimental astrophysicist Brian Keating is a colleague of Andrew's at UCSD and associate director of the Clarke Center. Also at the table was an old friend of Planetary Radio, physicist and award-winning science fiction author David Brin, a Clarke Center scholar in residence. We met in a lab at the university that had surprisingly good acoustics. Gentlemen, it is a pleasure to sit down with each of you here in this wonderful room. Thank you for building this for us at UC San Diego to talk about this terrific documentary, which you will be showing tonight, screening here for a public audience. But I was able to watch just a couple of hours ago, since I'm a good supporter of my local PBS station here in San Diego. It is a fascinating story and one that has fascinated me for many, many, many years, and perplexed me, as it does many people. Let's talk about this documentary and what it has to say about quantum mechanics. I noted, because I looked up the paper that the two of you are authors on, and that paper, I will even read the title, is Cosmic Bell Test Using Random Measurement Settings from High Redshift Quasars, or Quasars. And it was published in the Physical Review Letters on August 20th, just last year. You included in the opening of that, you and your colleagues, this great quote from Schrödinger, he of the famous cat, who said that entanglement was the characteristic trait of quantum mechanics, the one that enforces its entire departure from classical lines of thought. Correct me if I'm wrong, but in other words, a revolutionary way to understand all that is, this table we're sitting at and the rest of the universe.
So he was responding to a paper by Einstein and his colleagues about some strange things that they noticed in quantum mechanics. And Schrödinger said, yeah, that's right. Quantum mechanics really does predict these correlations that appear to be non-local, that appear to not be a simple result of some common cause.
Are that great quote from Einstein, spooky action at a distance, which comes up in the documentary, of course. All right. I guess we have to take, what's it going to take, 90 seconds to explain entanglement? But I want to, you guys decide amongst yourself who is best to give those people in our audience who don't already have some awareness of this, what we're talking about.
I guess I would say that in the classical physics world, when two systems are separate from each other, you can think of them as independent. But in quantum mechanics, when you have an entangled system, you can have a situation where it's not possible for those parts of the system to really be described independently of one another. So you can have an entangled pair of particles where one of them is very, very far away from the other. You make a measurement on one of them, and you instantly know something about a future measurement outcome of its partner, no matter how far away they are, no matter how long ago they became entangled. And there just is no classical physics explanation for this that makes any sense. And we're still struggling today with what it all means.
I was just going to say, I mean, the thing that makes it so interesting is when you learn about the history of this, you talk about entanglement. And I always get asked, well, why is it such a paradox? And it wasn't until I had deep conversations with Andy over here that I understood it, because I thought, well, if you have two pairs of socks in your drawer, one's red and one's blue, and you reach into your suitcase after packing and getting into your destination, you pull out your socks and you got one in red and one blue, then you know at home you left one red and one blue. And it wasn't until we had many conversations over this that I really began to appreciate, at more, you know, more than a layperson's level of understanding, why this is such a baffling and perplexing mystery.
David.
Let's put this in a very simple way for the listeners, and that is that most of us hear about entanglement when it comes to, say, cryptography or something like that. The Chinese have been making real progress. And so what you're talking about is a simple atomic reaction or electromagnetic effect creates two photons. They go heading off in opposite directions, so that the atom that made the two photons is standing still. Since they were generated, they had their beginning of their life from the same atom and the same event. When they're heading off in opposite directions, usually it turns out that they are entangled with each other. Their origins, it's like each one is leaving a little thread behind it that's connected to the other one. Now, there are other forms of entanglement that are more complicated, but the simplest type, and the type that these two fine gentlemen and their colleagues measured out on the Canary Islands, is just taking this simple reaction that creates two photons going in opposite directions. And if you can stretch this distance, say to outer space, or from one Canary Island to another Canary Island, then you have time to be able to let them settle in, and then you measure them at both ends with a simple polarimeter, like your Polaroid sunglasses, turning them at various angles. What they're talking about is the fact that if you turn the polarizer to any given angle, 37 degrees, and you measure whether or not that photon is going to get through or not get through. When you measure the other photon at the other Canary Island, at the other detector, it's going to have the complementary polarization. Right, Andy?
Yeah, so there'll be a correlation between those measurement outcomes that doesn't seem to be explainable by a local view of physics, the kind of thing that Einstein wanted to be true about the world.
Einstein liked the traditional view of space-time, right? And causality. You can't have an action here and have it affect something that is so far away that there can't possibly be any physical connection between those two objects, so we thought.
Einstein thought that quantum mechanics had to be incomplete because entanglement itself presented such a conundrum to him. He called it spooky action at a distance.
There's that quote.
Because it seemed to him that something done to one half of the system would instantaneously affect the state of something very far away. And he had very, very deep misgivings about quantum mechanics. And entanglement was really one of the things that he didn't like about it.
The history in this and the characters that were involved in it. I'm thinking of like the meeting that took place that is documented in the documentary in 1927, where you had maybe the greatest geniuses in the history of physics all gathered in one place debating this, and Einstein among them, coming up every night with some new argument for why quantum mechanics couldn't be real. Jason?
And apparently, by the end of the day, Bohr would come back with a counterargument about why quantum mechanics was consistent, and often Einstein would have to go back to his room and think about a new argument. And I think it culminated in Bohr being really stumped all day, and at the end, finally making the counterargument using Einstein's own general theory of relativity.
And this is one reason why physics has been one of the leading human endeavors that helped to reinforce the Enlightenment's belief that argument, fair, open argument, is what gets you to truth a lot quicker than anybody making grand declarations.
Science.
Science, as opposed to the way you had hierarchies in which kings or nobles or priests made grand declarations. It's the back and forth that this Nova show illustrates. Almost all Nova shows illustrate, but this one especially.
So the group we worked with has used various telescopes on the Canary Islands for various things. In a previous experiment, they actually sent entangled particles between the Canary Islands. It was 144 kilometers. In our experiment, they did not send entangled particles between the islands. We stuck to one island, but we still sent them about a kilometer in each direction, pointed at some of the biggest telescopes in the world. And the reason why we had to go to the Canary Islands was that it's sort of like Europe's Hawaii, in that it's a giant volcanic island in the middle of the ocean, and you could put telescopes up on the top and the clouds stay pretty low. Some of the biggest telescopes in the world are there, and we were able to use two of them simultaneously, and they were far enough apart that we could establish certain causal conditions, but they were close enough together that we could run the experiment often enough to get the data that we needed.
Yeah, essentially, while the entangled particles were in flight over this matter of microseconds, we would try to collect light from quasars on both sides and have a fresh measurement choice that was ready to go before the entangled particles arrived.
So we got to back up because, this is why you needed two big telescopes. I suppose you could have gone to Mauna Kea, you could have gone to the Atacama in Chile, but you had time on these telescopes. And you needed them because here you were going to use them to look at these objects, which are among the most distant in the galaxy, in the universe. They are, in fact, very distant galaxies. Why was it key to this experiment? And what was the point of using the light of these quasars to demonstrate that entanglement is a real thing? Because wasn't that really what you were doing? It was to eliminate the possibility that some other X factor was maybe making it look like things were entangled, but maybe they aren't really?
It's a little subtle. The thing that separates entanglement from kind of the classic story of pairs of socks, really, it's somewhere in between. You pull out one sock and you know what the other sock must look like because you only have pairs of similar colors. And actual influences going back and forth between the two particles. There are correlations that happen between these particles. And we wanted to make absolutely sure that those correlations were not caused by anything local on Earth. We wanted to push as far back as we could the place and the time at which any of those common causes could have been in place. And so one of the quasars we looked at emitted its light when the universe was only about 10% as old as it is today.
Long before the Earth formed.
Long before the Earth formed, billions of years ago.
And the reason why they used two quasars at opposite directions, and that's why they needed the telescopes. They didn't need the telescopes to check whether or not the particles were entangled with each other. But they looked in opposite directions to get light from two quasars that never met, that never knew each other. Because if they had been in the same part of space at any point in the last 13.8 billion years, they might have, in some underhanded way, conspired with each other how they would communicate with Jason and Andy 13.8 billion years in the future. But because they were selected from opposite sides of the universe, and the way they had traveled apart from each other, they could not have conspired so to speak. I'm a science fiction author, so I'm putting it in dramatic terms.
Conspiring galaxies.
Conspiring quasars, yes.
I hope you're thoroughly entangled in our conversation about entanglement. The best is ahead after this break on Planetary Radio.
40 years ago, my professor, Carl Sagan, shared his dream of exploring the cosmos with solar sails. The Planetary Society's LightSail 2 will soon become the first small spacecraft to be propelled only by the light of the sun. I'm Bill Nye, and I'll be there as a rocket carries our craft into orbit. Tens of thousands of members have made this day possible. Already part of our LightSail team? Thank you. It's never too late to join us. You can learn more at planetary.org/membership.
Hello, I'm Robert Picardo, Planetary Society board member and now the host of the Society's Planetary Post video newsletter. There's a new edition every month. We've already gone behind the scenes at JPL, partied at Yuri's Night, and visited with CEO Bill Nye. We've also got the month's top headlines from around the solar system. You can sign up at planetary.org/connect. When you do, you'll be among the first to see each new show. I hope you'll join us.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, continuing my conversation with David Brin, Andrew Friedman, Jason Galicchio, and Brian Keating about quantum mechanics and entanglement, that old spooky action at a distance. Here again is David Brin.
The fourth fellow sitting across from Matt here is an expert about the phase of the universe that I was just talking about, and that is the very beginning when the curtain came up and the hydrogen atoms deionized and let all the photons run free, and before that, all the way back to inflation. And so Brian Keating, author of Losing the Nobel Prize, he can tell us about that epoch and why Andy and Jason chose quasars.
And before you do that, Brian, for you guys, basically what you needed was the greatest random number generator in the universe. And I should mention, every week on this show, we do a contest, a space trivia contest, and we let the winner be decided among those who've answered the question correctly by random.org, which I believe actually uses the cosmic microwave background to get its random numbers, not quite as exact or as precise, maybe. I'm not sure of the word I want, as what you guys did with quasars. But the CMB and its place in all this.
I think it's extremely fascinating to think about how the ultimate object in the universe is the universe itself. And the question of whether or not you can describe the entire universe in quantum mechanical terms, both at its very origin, when it was perhaps quantum mechanical in size, you know, in terms of its physical size extent, but also whether or not you can describe the universe itself with a wave function, with one of these mysterious mathematical operators. And what's so fascinating about what these two guys, Jason and Andy, do is that they're really bringing down to Earth, no pun intended, how these quantum effects could be made manifest almost in our daily lives. And I think that's what's so fascinating. If you can think about how the universe behaves on a quantum scale, you might not care so much about that. But if it comes down to siphoning off your bank account because someone's been able to de-encrypt your password or some other effect like that, then I think it's much more relatable to the average person. In the work that we do, where we study the most ancient photons in the universe, these two guys have not yet pushed back to that horizon yet, but they are planning to.
Oh, really?
In all series. Yeah, Jason Galicchio is also an expert in the observation of the CMB, the cosmic microwave background radiation, having spent an entire year almost of his life at the bottom of the world, South Pole, Antarctica.
Well, I so didn't know the project that you document in your book.
It's an allied project. Yes, we were neighbors at the South Pole. Jason ran an entire telescope called the South Pole Telescope, the biggest.
I occasionally slept under the bicep telescope,
which is my telescope. And just to think about this connection between quarks and the cosmos, the quantum to the macroscopic universe. And I think that, I don't want to spill the beans, but I would be surprised if that wasn't in their near future horizon, that they want to push back even further to the quantum epoch, to perhaps to see if the universe featured quantum correlations that some maniacal demonic presence that David over here likes to speculate about could have played tricks with the very laws of physics itself, so that 13.8 billion years later, these two gentlemen and their colleagues would find just the results that they had.
And so now we come back to the Dilbert cartoon that I shared with all of you before we started recording from Sunday of March 3rd, where Dilbert has created a universe that includes quantum mechanics. He's asked, don't you think the smart people will be able to figure out that it's all rigged? And he said, no, I coded the people in this universe to not believe smart people. I believe all of you. And it has absolutely been a delight to be invited into your little toy store for a little bit. Brian, you may want to add something, but I also want to give you special thanks for hosting us for this today at the center.
It's our pleasure. And I want to thank the two scientists, Jason and Andy here, because they've not only, you know, provided a, you know, unveiled part of cosmic mysteries to us, but they also have done so in a very practical terms, providing educational opportunities for students here and elsewhere to get their PhDs, to understand more about the cosmos. And many of these students come from extremely diverse backgrounds and will contribute to society in untold ways. And I think that's, I once learned that the meaning of the word scientist in Russian, and the only one who can correct me is Sergey's cousin David over here, Bryn, which is that the meaning of the word scientist in Russian means one who was taught. It basically translates in that form. And to me, these two guys and their colleagues have really contributed to that obligation that scientists have and also the benefit that scientists receive from one another. So I want to thank you guys.
Thank you all thank once you. Again. Go Tritons. I hope we can talk again sometime.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Great.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Bruce Betts is the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. He is back once again to tell us about the night sky. Hopefully this will be a glitch-free What's Up. Keep that word in mind.
glitch.
How are things up there?
There's still stuff in the sky, if that's what you mean. There's Jupiter looking lovely. It's right around opposition, just past being on the opposite side of the Earth from the Sun, so closest for the year. Looking brighter than any bright star up there in the east in the early evening, in the south and by mid-evening. And it's hanging out near Scorpius, which means it's near the red star Antares. So you can check out Antares to the right of Jupiter. And then coming up a little later in the evening, and you can see over farther to the east, is yellowish Saturn. And if you look on June 15th or 16th, you'll also see the moon hanging out near Jupiter.
The sky has cheated me so far. I keep going out. It's clear during the day, and then it clouds over where I am. And so no chance to look at that big, pretty Jupiter, but maybe tonight.
That's the price you pay for nice weather by the ocean.
It's true.
We move on to this week in space history. It was 1963 that Valentina Tereshkova became the first woman in space, and 20 years later, 1983, that Sally Ride became the first American woman in space.
Couple of heroes.
We move on to Random Space Fact.
Be there.
One night only. No, actually, every night. So I wanted to address this little bit of a pet peeve of mine. People ask, what's the name of the moon? Well, in English, it's the moon. That's its name. Now, it is called other things, of course, in every other language, because not surprisingly, I think everyone noticed the moon in the sky. So, for example, the moon is known as Luna in Italian, Latin, and Spanish.
La Luna. From one of our favorite movies here.
Exactly like that. All right, we move on to the trivia contest. I ask you, what is the brightest pulsar as seen from Earth at radio wavelengths? How'd we do, Matt?
You were so clever to specify the wavelengths, because we got a lot of answers from people who came up with the brightest source in the sky, but that was in X-ray wavelengths. And so the answer I think you're looking for, which came from more than half the folks who submitted, the one that chosen by random.org anyway, was the Vela pulsar.
That is correct.
Well, congratulations, Devin Hubel, longtime listener, first-time winner in Clemens, North Carolina. Devin, you have picked up the prize this time around, and that means that you will be receiving a Planetary Society kick asteroid, rubber asteroid, a 200-point itelescope.net astronomy account from that worldwide nonprofit network of telescopes, and James Donovan's book, the new book, one of many, of course, out right now, but one that's getting great reviews, Shoot for the Moon, The Space Race and the Extraordinary Voyage of Apollo 11. I say a lot of books out right now. Yes, books specifically about Apollo.
Did you learn anything else from our listeners?
I sure did. I mean, we do pretty much every week. A lot of them, including Peter Carboni, mentioned that some pulsars, including Vela, have this quality which astronomers have very scientifically called a glitch or glitches.
I have those too.
Do you suddenly spin up in your rotation?
Sometimes.
Vela is the best known of all glitching pulsars, Peter shared, with glitches occurring on average every 3 years, but they are not predictable. And maybe needless to say, nobody knows why they happen.
I was hoping for an answer to my glitches, but oh well.
I'm sorry. Well, yours maybe may have a solution or an answer. Martin Hajoski, our friend in Texas. We're into the funny stuff now. Just make it obvious up front. Hela, while playing Layla at the gala at Vela, Eric Clapton's performance was Tayla made to shine bright on the radio. Now that's delivering the maila.
Oh.
Finally, this from Torsten Zimmer in Germany. Vela sounds like a pretty cool dude, but I still wouldn't want him to reside too close by in the neighborhood. And as far as radio signals go, I prefer planetary radio.
Aw, we're preferred over a pulsar. That's nice.
Thank you, Torsten. We're ready for another one of these, I believe.
All right, it's time once again to play Where in the Solar System? Where in the solar system is there a feature named Dagana, D-O-G-A-N-A, Dagana? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Well, doggone it.
Nice.
I'm trying too hard. You have until the 19th. That would be Wednesday, June 19 at 8 a.m. Pacific time. Someone is going to win a Planetary Society rubber asteroid, a 200-point, it's worth a couple hundred bucks, 200-point itelescope.net account. And I still have a lot of books to give away. I have a book, and this is mostly for young people, called The Space Race. It's very nicely illustrated by Sarah Crudas. And I, some people may have seen her appearing with me. I wasn't with her. She was with me on the recent special on the Discovery Channel about Bereshit, the Israeli lunar landing attempt. Sarah, delightful person, and she told me about this book. She sent a copy for us to give away. Maybe you will win it. It's really a very nicely illustrated book, a delight to read. So that will also go to our winner this week. And I think that's it.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about tongues. They're pretty cool. Thank you, and good night.
Yeah, I like using one. I don't want to eat one. It's one of my mother's favorite foods.
Oh,
I don't have to.
Geez,
I know, that's how I feel, that I have to go away when she does that. You're listening to Bruce Betts. He's the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. By the way, also the author of Astronomy for Kids, another beautifully illustrated book for young people that has appeal well beyond that, if I do say so myself. He joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by our entangled members. Mary Liz Bender is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan, at Astro.